So Michael just told me to introduce myself. I guess I know most of you. So that's me. And since I'm the experimentalist of the week, this is a talk with lots of experiments that are partly ongoing and many, many questions. So there's lots of open stuff in there. I hope to get some of your inputs. And of course, if you have questions or if I'm just forgetting some of the experimental details you want to know, just ask me. So we do semiconductor spintronics, and we use various types of materials. And I have here examples of all these three types of materials we work with. We work with wide gap 2/6s, with of course manganese in there to make them interesting. And we do some work on, there's a tunneling diode in the material system, which is ongoing, where there's some open questions. We work on 3-5 dilute magnetic semiconductors, gallium manganese arsenide, of course. We have this novel effect, which we've got tunnel AMR, and there are some open questions also remaining there. And then we work on 2-6 narrow gaps, mainly mercury telluride, where we can also add manganese. This is, of course, where we would hope to see something like the spin Hall effect. So far, we've not seen it. So I'll show you the experiments we've done. And so we don't see the spin Hall effect, at least to 10 to the minus 4. We don't see the anomalous Hall effect, the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect either, which is also something of a surprise. And I'd like to really ask the question here, how do we proceed? Wide gaps and 3-5s. The questions that I will be asking later on again is, in the spin RTDs we have quantum dots that show a finite spin splitting at 0B, and the question is why. Tunnel AMR has two questions. We see anisotropies that you don't expect from crystal symmetry. Perhaps we can find a reason why. And the other thing is, we see what we think is a metal insulator transition. We think we see the Efrostovsky gap, and there's some modeling questions surrounding that one. Lots of guys collaborating, also guys present here. Wide gap 2/6s, zinc manganese selenide. They're paramagnets, they're not ferromagnetic, but you have manganese in there. That means you get this giant G factor. You can have 100% spin polarized material, we hope, at fields of about a Tesla. So they're ideal to do some work. And one thing we do use them for, of course, they have the right impedance to do semiconductor spintronics. One thing is that once you have these materials, you always have to work with a majority spin. And that's nasty, because you want to have a full spintronic, so you also want to be able to address the minority spin. And the way we try to do so is by using resonant tunneling diodes, where we have a magnetic quantum well, and the hope is to be able to see the spin splitting of the conduction band in the quantum well, and to simply tune the spin up or spin down level by the bias across the RTD. And well, this is work that's been going on for a while. The main challenge is to be able to grow this type of stacks of materials. So we've been doing much more complex stacks now. The big experimental challenge is that this material that you want to use for the barrier has a different lattice constant, so it's strained, so you have to with strain compensation, and you cannot simply use any other stack you can think of. So this costs some optimization. But it does work. And what you see here is two devices. This is already a bit older. What you see here is two devices where you have manganese in the well. At zero field, you have a single resonance in your IV curve. And then if you apply a perpendicular field, you see that this single resonance neatly splits up. So that basically does mean that we are capable of at least seeing the density of states in the quantum well. The density of states seems to follow what you expect from the giant Zeeman splitting. What of course we don't know yet is whether these guys are really spin filters. So A, do they discriminate the spin of the incoming electrons? And B, is the spin of the electrons that come out of it in any way related to the spin of these levels? So that's the kind of stuff that we're doing right now. And a simple way to address, for example, the spin filter, or the ingoing spin discrimination effect, is simply to go to higher B fields. Because at higher B fields, also your injector becomes spin polarized. Of course, also your heat detector does, but that doesn't matter for this type of experiment. And so the thing is now, we've seen these nice two peaks at 6 tesla, where we know that the giant Zeeman is saturated and much bigger than that in Leeds. If you go to 14, 16 tesla now, you should see that also this guy becomes polarized, and you should see one of the peaks go away. Well, that's basically what we do see. This is one example of this type of experiment. So this is just a single sample. Here you see the trace, or similar to the traces I just showed you. You have these two peaks here. If you go to 14 tesla, you see that this guy drops down, and that's what you expect, because now all the incoming spins have this majority spin character. So indeed, what this does mean is we can discriminate between up and down spin of the incoming electrons. And what we're doing right now is some modeling to really quantify the degree of spin selection we can get in these wafers. This is a similar type of experiment. So what we try to do is to keep the Zeeman splitting in the leads at a given value in the emitter. And of course, what you see then at higher temperatures is that indeed the peak goes away again. The collaboration that we do here, the modeling that we do here, is in collaboration with Davos Sanchez. Sorry. This peak here is very likely a phonon replica still of the first peak. So this is the LO phonon. This is the LO phonon. Yeah, so there's a very strong LO phonon coupling in these two sixes, and this guy you keep on seeing. So, and this is not the best of samples to work on. So this second peak was already a bit well. No, this just has to do with the experiment. This you see here, the second peak was already very strongly reduced. Usually it's much bigger than this one. And if you go two slides back, previous. You see that this peak here is much bigger. So basically, this little bugger here, which is the peak that you saw, which is the phonon replica that belongs to this guy here. 70? No, it's much bigger than that. Yeah, it's more like 40. Yeah. So that's basically what we like to know for the modeling. That's the question that I'm asking here. Is what you can get out of this modeling is two things. One is the ratio of coherent to incoherent tunneling through the quantum well, and the other one is the speed by which a spin, which is in the upper spin state, relaxes to the lower spin state. So we have basically two parameters to describe the experiment. And what I need is numbers for this spin lifetime in the quantum well. And this should be something that has been calculated. There's lots of optical experiments, of course, in the literature, but they always have work on undoped systems. And if you have an undoped system, you basically measure the whole relaxation time. So what I need is the spin relaxation time in a simple quantum well, which is basically only the electron spin. So that's one request from here to here. Dope with the manganese, yes. And I think Carlos is here or was here. He did some work years ago on this, Carlos Egues, but it doesn't really apply to this experiment. So that's one number that I would like to get him. I would expect this to be long, actually, because it's just an electron spin. Okay, so that's one question. The other question has to do with self-assembled dots in our RTDs. So this is one way to go to quantum dots. Of course, we also try to make them the hard way with top-down lithography. So one way to make these quantum dots is you can do cat selenide, which has a different lattice constant than zinc selenide. And so it's basically the same as indium arsenide on gallium arsenide. You grow a few layers of this cat selenide, you wait a while, and it will self-organize into quantum dots. They're not as nice as what you're used to in the indium arsenide world, but you get quantum dots. Now, what you would like to have is manganese in there, in the quantum dots. That's very difficult to achieve, because usually the manganese is on the sides or on the edges. So what we chose to do here is actually to have the manganese incorporated in the barrier. So the barrier is 30% beryllium and some manganese. And now we hope that the wave functions of these cotton dots will penetrate in the barrier and there sample the manganese and get a giant G-mon.
So is it a voltaic
structure? No. It's all cubic. It's all cubic. Yeah. So that's basically what you do. And of course, if you make a mesa out of this material, you have 100,000 quantum dots, and you see all kinds of vague things. Basically, you don't see very much. This is just the IV curve. But what happens is that usually one of these quantum dots is the first one to turn on. This is something that's also known from the 3-5s. So basically, you have to be lucky. But you're lucky most of the time. And what you see here is an IV curve. And here the current turns on. And what you see is, if you amplify the current, what you see is indeed some very neat structure here. And so we got lucky here, but basically you get lucky in 60% of the samples. Structure may be somewhat different, but usually there's only one quantum dot that starts first. And then later on you will see more structure. If you blow this one up, you see many more peaks, and you don't know whether they belong to the same quantum dot or other ones. But anyway, here you have a chance that this is one quantum dot. What also we don't know is actually what quantum dot this is. What we expect is that it's a quantum dot that's filled with, say, 3 or 4 electrons. You can work that out from the band structure. Now this is the structure once again at 3 different temperatures. And what we do now is simply apply the field. I'm trying to get that to work. And what you see is that when we apply a field, we see a huge effect on these lines here. Now this directly means already that we have some influence on the manganese, because the normal G factor of the zinc selenide is too small to see these big effects in such a small field range.
It seems to me that the lowest temperature curves were not the sharpest.
That's a good observation. It's the second cooldown, and the second cooldown they were not as sharp as the first cooldown. And we couldn't get that back. So there are some, if you go from cooldown to cooldown, we were lucky enough to get basically the same structure. But apparently, the exact line width of these lines has different influences, which can vary from cooldown to cooldown. Now that's not unknown for quantum worlds. You can have perturbative sites close by, but I couldn't give you the exact mechanism. So this is actually the same data again. This is the bias. This is the field. Actually, this is a derivative of the IV curve. And what you see is these 3 sharp lines are here. And you can vaguely see the 4th line, which is here, which is a broader line. The important point now is that you see the overall behavior. And what you see is that this line goes to lower bias and then saturates with B field. This one goes to higher bias and saturates with B field. And you see something like an anti-crossing here. Now this proves a couple of things. One thing is that indeed we see this Brillouin-like behavior that we expect for the giant Zeeman. So what we do see is indeed evidence that the barium manganese mixes in with the wave functions on the dot. The other thing we observe is that we have this anti-crossing here plus a Zeeman pair, because this one goes down and this one goes up. So we see states from a single quantum dot, otherwise we could not see this. So that's nice, we really have the single quantum dot. But the quite interesting and unexpected thing is that basically we see a finer splitting of the Zeeman levels at 0 B field. And that's funny, because this is supposed to be a pattern magnet. And this is actually a quite general thing. We see this in other samples, we see this at other resonances. So this is actually the same sample, but at a higher bias. Now, this may just be other quantum dots. I guess this is other quantum dots coming into resonance. What you see is lots of loads of lines. And they all come in these Zeeman pairs. And you see that at high B fields, they neatly line up with the Brillouin fit. But at 0 B field, they all have a finer splitting. This varies a bit from pair to pair, but we always have this splitting at 0 B field. So it's really a general thing. You get all of these samples. So this is, the previous one was 1.3K, this is 4K, this is 10K, and they simply follow the Brillouin function for the material, so very nicely. Now, the question, of course, is how can this be? Well, we've been working on this with Pavel, and there's also work by Bray already on this. One thing is that indeed you can expect, if you have a couple of electrons in these dots, you can expect, because of the exchange with the manganese, to get something like ferromagnetic or aligned behavior also at zero B field. However, you expect this to occur only at very low temperatures, somewhere below 1 Kelvin. Now, the effects we see really are robust up to 20 Kelvin, which is about a limit where we can do these type of experiments, because then everything is thermally broadened. So it's a much stronger effect. Now, as to explain that, we invoke a paper by Efros and Rajpa, who predicted some kind of a runaway effect if you do spin injection through a magnetic quantum dot. So that's a paramagnetic quantum dot again with now with the single manganese in there. And this is a kind of runaway effect. The idea is the manganese will have a given orientation, and because of this given orientation which you have when you start the experiment, it will select electrons to go with that spin to go through the quantum dot. Now, once these electrons go through the quantum dot in the transport experiments, the manganese spin sees the electron spin, aligns a bit further according to the electron spin, and gets a bit more into a certain position. Now, the second electron comes in, sees the manganese, which is in a better position, so the second electron is even more thoroughly selected and has the right spin to go with the manganese and go through the dot. The third electron sees a very well-aligned manganese and has no choice but to become very well-aligned with the manganese and goes through. So this is a self-amplification effect, which really should give you a very strong spin polarization of the injected current. Now, this theory is only valid for a single manganese spin in the quantum dot. And of course, what we suggest now is that the effect we see is due to a similar runaway effect. But what we need is to extend this theory to an ensemble of spins surrounding our single quantum dot. So that's another thing that I would like to discuss over the coming week or so.
Does that effect depend on rate of current compared to spin relaxation rate or something?
You mean what we see or what's the predictions?
That mechanism.
That mechanism should depend on these type of issues. What we see is something that directly, as soon as we measure the current, shows a finite splitting.
Okay, so not able to verify that?
That there's a startup there. No, we're not able to verify that. But
or
that
depends on the magnitude of the current.
Well, that's something we could still try. We have not really tried. Well, no, we cannot try because the current is given by the bias, right? So this is a one-to-one relationship in RFV curve. So we cannot do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. That's in some sense nonlinear.
Right. And does it make sense that even in a regime where you start to not?
I cannot say.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that's something I hope we can try and work out whether that makes any sense. I mean, this is the best explanation we could come by so far. Okay, gallium manganese arsenide. Well, I guess this you all know. It's ferromagnetic. TC is pretty much fixed at 170. All other rumors you may have heard are nonsense, we can meanwhile say. The important thing with gallium manganese arsenide is that we are finding more and more that the anisotropy, both in transport and magnetic, is very, very complex. And this, of course, derives directly from the fact that the carriers are holes, so you get the full anisotropy of your hole band, your valence band, going into the physics of these materials.
Gordon?
Yeah?
Can you expand a bit more on that comment regarding the layers?
Yeah, well, there are problems with the data analysis of that paper. Basically, they did not do a proper magneto resistance measurement, so they have a funny way to extract the magneto resistance from their data. And if you look at the raw data, well, there could be something there, but it's gone at lower temperatures. So So they see something like hysteretic behavior in those data, which is there at 250, which is gone at low temperatures. Which to me suggests that at least it's not kosher ferromagnetism. It could be something to do again with magnetic clusters in there or super paramagnetism. The other thing is that a couple of groups have tried to reproduce those results and they get nowhere. Not that I know of. But then it's very difficult to grow proper two-dimensional structures. Because of the low temperature growth issues there. Well, once the manganese is on a site, it should be, then I guess it anything should not be the big problem. But it's very difficult to get proper two-dimensional behavior. Perhaps if you start again with single monolayers, but that work has been done a couple of years ago and also wasn't very conclusive. It would be important to get this up, I fully agree. But, yeah. 170 is what we have to live with for now. If anybody knows a way to get more manganese in and get it active, then of course that would be a way to go. So this is a graph that some of you may have seen already. This is how we came across tunnel AMR. This is a very simple sample. We grow gallium manganese arsenide, a thin layer, 20 nanometers, say. We make a tunnel barrier aluminum oxide, and we contact it with gold. And what we do now is we measure the magnetoresistance for a given direction of the B field in the plane of the sample. And what you expect to see is nothing, because you only have one ferromagnetic layer and the other one is a normal metal. But what you do see is a pretty clear spin fault behavior. This is the background resistance of the gallium manganese arsenide. But you see a switch between a low resistance state and a high resistance state. So this is a novel type of spin valve-like signal, or at least a signal that switches between two levels. And the mechanism is in this anisotropy of the material. So the next slide, I will show you a series of these scans, taken for various angles of the magnetic plane of the magnetic field in the plane of the sample. So we really probe the anisotropy of the valence band. And what you see is that actually the signal that you measure, and I'm not showing the hysteretic counterparts here, the signal that you measure depends very much on this angle. You always have a switch between a high resistance state and a low resistance state, but where exactly you do the switch and how much of either state you have really depends on the orientation of your B field. But that directly implies indeed you have some anisotropy there. The other thing is that the gallium manganese arsenide, as we're becoming now more and more aware, has a biaxial magnetic anisotropy. So basically these zinc blender materials should have six-fold anisotropy just the way that you get from the zinc blender structure. Now, by growing a thin layer, you already break through the strain, the symmetry in your vertical direction, but you're left with the two main axes in the plane, and you expect these zinc blender materials to have these two easy axes. So what you get is this biaxial anisotropy, which is quite important for explaining what's going on in these TMR experiments. You have a biaxial anisotropy, which depends on the electrostatic energy. At a given external field, you will also have a Zeeman energy. And what you also have is various uniaxial axes, which are present in basically all samples. And the degree to which they are present really depends from grower to grower, from group to group. Now, what we seem to have is an extra uniaxial anisotropy along one of these two easy axes, along, say, 100, which means that one of the easy axes is a bit easier than the other one, but we still have two easy axes. What you get from this electrostatic energy is an energy landscape that looks like this. Now, the next thing to know is that the switching that you get in these samples that we have is not a coherent rotation. They're too big for that. So what is happening in our samples is actually that you will nucleate a domain wall, say in a corner of the sample, and this domain will propagate to the sample, and it basically can tunnel, well, it can go through the energy barrier you have between the two configurations. Now, evidence that we have these two easy axes you get from squid, but you really have to make sure that you have the B field at the right angle. So you have to resolve it. You have to have the B field somewhere at an angle between these two easy axes, and what you get is a nice double step stretching behavior in this material. And the other thing that goes in the explanation, basically, is the fact that you have strong spin orbit in these materials, and that means that for different magnetization directions in your material, you get a very different Fermi surface with a different density of state at the Fermi energy. And that basically explains the effect. My tunnel resistance will simply be proportional to the density of states of the magnetic layer underneath, and if I just change my magnetization, I will see a different density of states and I will see a different resistance. That's the explanation of the effect, and it should occur in many more samples than just these semiconductors. Now here's a calculation of the amplitude of the effect as a function of basically the K selection in the barrier. And you see you can get effects of a few percent. Actually, what we saw was 5%, and we think we're somewhere here on these graphs here. You can also have negative effects. It just depends on the details of the band structure, what you will really see. But the amplitude is quite reasonable that we observe. And combining everything together, you end up with a polar graph like this here, where the blue areas are the high resistance state, the white areas are the low resistance state. The points here are the experimental data where we see switching between these two states. And the drawn lines are calculated from this very simple expression for the energy surface. And you see we have a very nice description of what's going on. So indeed, this is a proper description for the effect. And of course, an application would be at 4 Kelvin. You can write information into your material in a given direction with the B field. You go back to zero B fields, and you can read out the magnetization direction of your material simply by measuring the resistance. So if we can get it to room temperature, and that's something we hope, of course, this would be an interesting type of thing to go at. So something we are doing right now is characterizing actually the anisotropy that we see in many of these layers. This turns out to be a very simple way to do it. You simply measure the AMR, and you plot it with a good contrast. And what you can get, this is actually all calculations, what you can get for different types of magnetostatic landscapes, you look at, this is again a polar plot, but now for the AMR. And if you look at the center of your polar plot, now perhaps I should go back a few slides. What you should look at is the center here of your polar plot. And of course you could do the same thing with TAMR, but that's a bit more complicated because you have to make many, many samples. You can do the same thing AMR to check what's going on in your sample. What you get is that if the anisotropy, magnetic anisotropy, is fully biaxial, the centerpiece of your polar plot will be this nice checkerboard square. If you have now a small uniaxial extra anisotropy along one axis here, you will see that these points here open up. And if you have a uniaxial at 45 degrees, you will see that a square becomes a rectangle. So this is a very easy way to directly characterize actually the anisotropies you have present in your material. And what we're doing currently is characterizing material of various groups. Just to show you some results of on our own material, this is AMR on some of our material, and what you see is basically we have this square in the middle. So it's indeed we have this these two axes there, and you see that we have an opening here of these points, which means indeed that we have this O1 breaking. Now we see this type of breaking actually for samples from various groups. It will be present, we think it's present everywhere, but the amplitude of these different types of anisotropies really depends on the growth details. And so that's one of the questions I have. Why can we have these type of anisotropies? O1 is not expected from crystal symmetry, so it must be something else, perhaps something kinetic. We have no idea. And this is just an extra plot. This is the same sample taken at 40 degrees. And what you see now is that we have a uniaxial axis. And this is actually predicted from calculations you can do with this effective field model. just because of thermalization, you get a different occupation of your light and heavy hull levels. Because of that, your strain changes. And at high temperatures, just below TC, you have a uniaxial axis at 45 degrees, which is the dominant axis in your material. Anyway, so this is the question, why do we have all these anisotropies here? Okay, taking this a bit further, if you take samples where you have now two gallium manganese arsenide layers, this used to be called a TMR stack, you can use gallium arsenide as a buffer. This is low temperature grown, so gallium arsenide at low temperatures basically is a getter for all kinds of carriers you have, and you pin the Fermi level mid-gap. These guys have the Fermi level in the valence band, so you will have an energy barrier in between the two, and this acts as a TMR stack. This is what everybody thought so far, and this is a TMR curve. The black one here, you see two peaks, positive signals at fields here. And of course, once you know about TAMR, the question is how much of this signal is TAMR? Now, we took this sample at a different angle in our cryostat, and what you see is that this same sample now shows a switching from a high resistance to a low resistance state. So all we see here, basically, is TAMR. But that may not be a surprise. It's somewhat bigger than the single layer TAMR, but that's, of course, also what you expect. And the other evidence that we see TAMR also in these stacks dominating is that if you take the B field perpendicular to the plane, a TMR should give you no effect. And what you see here is we see a large magnetoresistance and some hysteretic effect as well. This can only be explained if you assume we have TAMR, so the density of states effect, active in these samples. Now, what's somewhat more interesting is that if you go to a single spin valve curve and you lower the bias and you lower the temperature, what you see first is it's taken at 4 Kelvin, and you lower the bias to lower and lower biases, you see that the spin valve signal goes up, goes up, goes up. And if you go to 1.7 Kelvin and a really low bias of 100 microvolts, you have a signal which has a resistance difference of about 1500 volts between the on state and the off state. At the same time, our polar plots go wild. I mean, you remember this butterfly-like behavior we saw a while ago. What you see is if you lower and lower the bias, you see you get much more structure on your polar plot. And at these very low temperatures, you get an enormously pointed structure in your system. So basically, this looks no longer as a simple band structure effect. And what we expect that's happening is that we really see quantum interference effects. And our assumption now is that what we're seeing here is actually we see the metal go the material go from metallic to insulating. So what we think is we open up a Eflorsky gap at the Fermi level when we go to the off state here. There's one thing you should realize of. Because of the nature of a tunnel barrier, we indeed have a depletion of the carriers towards the tunnel barrier, because they're basically being sucked into the tunnel barrier. So we indeed will have a lower density of the holes very close to the tunnel barrier where we have our tunneling. And the other thing is, of course, if we say this, we need to have some evidence. Well, this is part of the evidence. If we take an IV curve in what we think is the metallic state, we plot G, the conductance, versus the bias. We see that the conductance goes with the square root of the bias. Now, this is what you expect for localization in the metal after an Aronov. If you go to the insulator, it becomes very difficult to take an IV curve, but what we get out is something like this here, which goes with where the conductance goes with the fourth power of the bias. Now, this is what you expect for a Eflorsky insulator when it's two-dimensional. So this is already very, very hard or very strong evidence indeed that this is going on. It's very difficult. You can't fit anything. So this happens all between 4 and 1.3 Kelvin. And that means that within the error bars we have, so it's not inconsistent, that's what I can say. I mean, it's certainly exponential. To check what's going on, and actually this is working on a suggestion of Slavsky, what we did is we calculated what happens with an acceptor-like impurity, acceptor hydrogen-like impurity, in a ferromagnetic gallium arsenide for different orientations of the magnetization. And basically what I would like to do with this here is just bounce it off you and discuss whether this is all valid what we do here. So we've ventured into theory. What we have done is we calculate actually the whole wave function in k-space for a Luttingen Hamiltonian where we have the spin orbit and the PD exchange and everything in there plus the strain. So you can cast it in a form like this here. This is the guy that did all the work. So basically you can do this in k-space, and then he has all kinds of very nice pictures on how he samples point in k-space that he then uses to calculate the wave functions in real space. So his thesis is full of this stuff. The colors are not as nice here as they are here. But anyway, so out he gets is a wave function which basically resides in the top of the valence band system. And what he can do is he can now fit hydrogen wave functions in k-spaces to the numerical solution to obtain something like the Bohr radius. So we get a Bohr radius out for our material, and so basically what we can get is plots like this, where we have the Bohr radius for our hydrogen-like impurity in a magnetic gallium arsenide-like host. And this is just to show actually what we get. This is the wave function without any strain in our layer. So this is just the full crystal structure. And if I'm lucky, everything works. And what you see is that how the wave function varies. So you see a very anisotropic wave function. But of course, the extreme end of this wave function don't do very much. That's because we don't have the strain in there. So we can indeed get the wave function calculated for this type of system. Now I have to stop this. Stop. So this is real space now, yes. Yeah, this is real space calculated from momentum space using all these k points. Now if you put in strain, of course this is a bit dangerous because you can put in strain as much as you like. But we have put in the strain parameters and the PD parameters we used previously with Thomas Jungwirth to model the TAMR results. If we do that, we get this behavior for two different magnetization. So the plane has been tilted 90 degrees again. But you see we get these two configurations for the Bohr radius for the two magnetization directions along these two easy axes. So the tunneling direction is perpendicular to this. It's in this direction here. And you see that we have an enormous difference actually in this Bohr radius. And this is really again a strain effect. The strain is very important in all of these things here. And so this is what we think that drives this metal insulator transition. What you get is a very different Bohr radius of your manganese impurity when you switch your magnetization. And because of that, you turn the system through the metal insulator transition. So that's what we think might be happening, and that's what I hope we can discuss over the coming week, whether this makes any sense or not. You can already estimate that, well, this is the tunnel direction, this one here and this direction here. Actually, the change in Bohr radius we get for this tunnel direction is already enough to explain the difference in tunnel resistance that we get. On top of that, you might get some extra depletion effects, but this is already enough to do it. Another thing that we need is actually to characterize these fluctuations we saw in our polar plots. And there's not very much theory there, at least not that I'm aware of. There's a theory by Reich and Rusin, which is a quote here. They basically predict a distribution for the amplitude of the fluctuations depending on the configuration of your tunnel barrier. So you can have hopping transport, you have insulators, so you have hopping transport. And what you can have now is this situation where you have a tunnel barrier and you will have lots of 1D paths coming through the tunnel barrier causing your transport. Or you can have a configuration where you need to create a 1D path in a tunnel barrier for the transport. And they give different statistics And what we expect actually for our type of samples is that we get this type of distribution here, because we think we have this type of sample. We get this type of distribution for the fluctuations that we have in our experiment. And if you, well, what you can do is you take the fluctuation from this guy here, and what you see basically is a distribution which indeed is tending to the left side of the diagram, which is what we expect. But now the question is this allowed? So this Reich and Rosen theory basically gives you the fluctuations that you see if you do an experiment where you scan the Fermi energy from basically zero to just below the metal-insulated transition. What we do here in this polar plot is, well, somewhat the same. We also vary our Fermi energy, but just a little bit, because of the difference in density of state for the different magnetization orientations. So it's kind of risky to directly apply this Reich and Rosen theory to this type of fluctuations that we observe here. And so this is not a question. Is this a healthy way to analyze this? I'm looking for a way to analyze these fluctuations that we measure. And so is this the way to go on, or is there better ways? I'd like some extra evidence that indeed these fluctuations are quantum fluctuations. Okay, well, I'm not doing that badly. The last part of the talk is about our narrow gap work. There's some introduction here. Well, I won't talk about all of this here. Oh, I should have taken all of this out. Anyway, I'll just give you an introduction on mercury telluride quantum wells, because they may be important for all these things related to the spin Hall effect, and I'll show some of the results that we have so far, and this I will just all skip. So there's a bunch of other collaborators here. Gerrit and Junichiro. Gerrit is here, Junichiro will be here, I think. Of course, I worked with Thomas and Jairo and Evelina, who's also here. Mercury telluride is a kind of weird material. It used to be fashionable 15 years ago because of the military, who made night vision out of it. Then it got out of fashion, but it's coming back, I hear. There's things you can do with mercury telluride that you cannot do with the 3-5 narrow gaps. So I think it's coming back, which is good for us. We do relevant work. Anyway, mercury...
By the way.
Is this going to be published worldwide?
No, it's public.
Ask me tonight. Okay, so the thing with mercury telluride is that it is below zero here in this table of the gap versus the lattice constant. So it's a funny material. And it's negative gap, actually. It means that basically it's an inverted semiconductor. So the symmetries of the valence band and the conduction band change position. You also see it's here in this awkward part of the zinc blender lattice constant regime. It means that you can hardly work with any proper substrates we use. Well, when we have a lot of money, we buy zinc cadmium telluride, so this is also made for these military guys. That's more or less lattice matched here. But you can work in this regime, and if you want to work narrow gaps, this is a great material, because you can really tune it all the way. So this telluride here, well, these guys we don't work with, but manganese, of course, we do stick in. So we can have this material, which is narrow gap. We can make it a giant Zeeman material, and of course, because it's narrow gap, it has a giant Rush bar. But it has a kind of a funny Rush bar, because the valence and conduction band are so close together, everything mixes up. Now this is the valence band structure of a normal semiconductor. So we have some cadmium in there, now we have a normal semiconductor. The valence band is gamma 6, and the conduction band is gamma 6, the valence band is gamma 8. And you see here in mercury telluride just the other way around. So that's what meant by negative band gap. And you see here that actually we have here the valence band system hitting the conduction band system. This is actually a zero gap material. Now, whether it's truly zero gap or not is apparently still something that's under debate. It's very difficult to make those things stick, of course, because, yeah, well, any impurity will give you some conductance that shouldn't be there and everything. Anyway, the material is a zero gap system, as already indicated here. Now, what you can do now is you can play with this.
Zero direct gap.
It's zero direct gap, yes.
Back to the other one then.
Yep.
at the bottom of this.
It's the same, right? It's gamma again.
Yeah, so does actually, if you took the band structure, is there a gap or not? Or is there a place where the density state vanishes?
Not here. I mean, well, basically, it's well, zero gap, yeah.
But I mean, elsewhere in the Ruhlmann zone, it falls below. Right?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is really the you should have the crossing. So,
okay, I see.
Yeah, this is both gamma. Yeah, so it's pretty clean actually. Okay, now you can play tricks because sometimes you want zero gap, sometimes you don't want it, and you can play these tricks by making quantum wells of mercury telluride with mercury cadmium telluride barriers. And yeah, from this what you have to look at, of course, is the wave function of gamma 6 and gamma 8. And what you see here is that gamma 6 in mercury telluride is below gamma 8, so you can have very funny type 3 quantum wells if you go to this material system. And now it depends on the width of the well whether the lowest bound state is that of a direct or of an inverted semiconductor. And, oops. This is basically the picture. What you can have here, what you have here is the band structure of mercury telluride quantum wells for various thicknesses. And what you see here is that if you go to very thin quantum wells, say 4 nanometers, you really have a splitting again between the lowest electron level derived from the electron-like band, from the gamma 6, and the lowest gamma 8 band. So if we have a thin quantum well, we simply have a normal semiconductor which behaves type 1 like everything we know about. If you go to thicker quantum wells, and this is an example of it, the electron level drops strongly in energy. And now what you get is actually that the highest level that's derived from the gamma 8, which is this H1 level, actually becomes the lowest electron level. And what you get now is an inverted semiconductor. And so you can really play lots of tricks with this of material system. And of course, because all of this mixing here, you get a lot of the spin orbit that you have in the valence band into this electron state. So this is a material with a very strong spin orbit. What about it?
Well, how good are they?
How good are they? Yeah. Oh, they're pretty good. They're pretty good, yes. I mean, the manganese is usually the problem. The manganese, you never know whether it remains in the quantum well or diffuses it a little bit. We're getting better and better mobilities. I'll show you in a minute, we get a million now, so the interfaces cannot be so bad. This is actually the next graph. So this is actually quite recent. This is a gated sample. You see we've been at it for a long time. At Würzburg has been at it for a very long time. What you see here is basically just a quantum well modulation doped. Actually, it need not be. You usually get your carriers from anywhere in these materials. This is the problem with the narrow gaps. You always have traps and you always have carriers. So we have a gate on top. And with this gate, for example, here we define two different densities. This density here is 4 times 10 to the 11, so we're finally also getting to lower densities. This is a few times 10 to the 12. And what you see here is simply a Hall and quantum Hall. But the important thing actually here is that this Hall here is absolutely straight. So in this material, we don't see anything like anomalous Hall effect. Neither do we see it when we put manganese in. And this is something you would be tending to expect, giving all these theories on the Berry phase background of the quantum Hall effect. So we don't see them yet. Of course, this is a bulk system. Perhaps we have to go to ballistic-like systems to see them. Now, this is a calculation that we did for this specific structure. We have a last spin polarization in this material. It's at least 20-30% at 1 Tesla. We have a large rush bar of the order of 10 millivolts, and we don't see an intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. Why? Yep.
You said that as a Hall conductivity?
I could plot it for you. This is just the resistance. I could plot it, yeah. I could make it for you. I have.
For what part of that figure?
I mean, I'm just saying that this guy here is a perfectly straight line. That's my statement. Nothing else. And we've gone back. I mean, there have been some publications in the past that showed in bulk mercury telluride something which looks like an almost Hall effect. Well, my suspicion now is that these guys have been measuring the inductance of the cluster. Oh, there's some publications of the Westbrook group years ago where they first had, I mean, these were very very early cryostats, and these measurements take forever if you wait a long time for the cryostat to settle. So if you see anybody claiming an almost Hall effect, I mean, I've been kicking my guys a long time to do these experiments very carefully. This takes half a day to measure, and then everything anomalous is gone. Two different gate voltages. So one is a lower density, 4 × 10^11, and the other one is, say, a couple of times 10^12. That's the difference. But it's actually a cute material. If you lower the gate voltage even further, I don't know whether that works for this sample here. But some samples that we have, we try to get depletion, of course. But you don't get depletion. You have an N-type material, you go to zero, you have a P-type material directly on. So the carriers are everywhere, and the pinning is. That's a good question. That's something I still want. This is data from last week, so I still have to discuss this with my dear students. Yeah. So it may well be the contacts are not perfect. That's my. So there's not a problem with this material. The contacts are made by indium alloying, and this is not the best way to make contacts. So you may have some selective population of the edge states. I don't know. I mean, you also see that I have this. These features here, which could be resonant reflection of the Hall plateaus, I don't really know. But that's something. I don't think it's. Well, don't think so. I think, again, this is selective reflection. So this is something I still have to look into. Now, when you lower the density of materials, this is one reason why they didn't do it before, the contacts get worse. And you can expect these type of effects. Okay, sorry, I should go back to the previous one. One thing, so we don't see an intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. One thing that Yunichiro allowed me to introduce here is that he has a new paper where he does the Furtes correction for the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. And he shows that indeed, just like the spin Hall effect, if you have a linear in K spin orbit splitting, the Furtes correction cancels the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect. So that's perhaps not such a surprise. So you cannot measure the intrinsic anomalous Hall effect if you have a pure linear in K Rajpa. Now the thing is, the Rajpa that we have in mercury telluride is not linear in K, it's cubic more or less. And we also seem to see not a anomalous Hall effect in mercury manganese telluride. Now this may have many, many reasons. You would expect magnetic impurities to bring the effect back. We don't seem to see it. Now this is an example of a calculation of the Rajpa. This was our record Rajpa sample, where we have about 30 millivolt Rajpa splitting in this material. But the main reason to show it here is to give you an impression, because of the mixing of the bands. The Rajpa splitting actually first goes with K cubed, which is basically because you're in a whole band, so it's K cubed and not linear in K. And then it saturates and turns over. So it's a very complex behavior. It really depends on the Fermi energy, what you really get. So it may be that we're somewhere here, and it's more or less linear, and that's why we have the canceling. But that's something we still have to look into. Well, some things we tried. This is a paper which Evelina published 1.5 years ago now. This was the infamous H-bar. Of course, this H-bar came from somewhere. We tried this experiment. Basically, this experiment was to show that you could see the spin Hall in a transfer experiment. That's what we're after, by making an H-bar. And the idea is, if you have an electrical current here, then momentum conservation, angular momentum conservation, should drive a spin current in this direction here. And the spin current in turn should give you an electrical potential difference in the longitudinal direction between these two guys here. Now this is a simulation of this experiment, showing it should work if you have small enough samples. We tried the experiment in a very big sample, which was the smallest we could make at the time. We're getting there now. We have new lithography up and running to make smaller samples. This was the H-bar. And the effect is at least smaller than 10 to the minus 4, and we cannot measure any better than that in this type of structures. So we could not see it there. But again, here the Rasmussen splitting is, and so you could just say there is no effect because of the vertex, but the Rasmussen splitting is not linear in K. So why? Just to show that we can see some effects. This is a very recent paper. What we looked at actually is RNO bone-like oscillations in a small ring structure in this material, and what we have a gate on top again, and we can really tune the RASPA through zero simply by going for the gate voltage. So we've done so and measured RNO bone-like oscillations, and so this is a graph showing that indeed we get oscillations. The important point is that we have zero RASPA along this line here, this gate voltage line. And along this line, we get patterns like this here, which is simply an Abom oscillations. And if you go to any other point in this diagram here, you get these very complicated fork diagrams. And now we think that this is a consequence of the spin interference through the Aronoff-Cartier mechanism. And what you see here is actually our experiment. And this is a calculation of Evelina again for this gate voltage, for the RASPA we think is present there. And you see at least, you see the Q lines occurring here, and they're interconnected by perpendicular lines. They're more or less similar to what we get here. And for zero RASPA, you see that this is really absent. So we think indeed here that what we see here is the observation of really something that's related to a Berry phase. We think we have here the Aronoff-Cartier phase directly in these type of strong spin orbit materials. But we had to go to very small but controlled spin orbit to see anything. Okay, so that's the end of my talk. The main question, summarizing again, we had these self-assembled dots that showed in our RTDs a finite spin splitting at 0B, and we'd like to know why. We have this TAMR in gallium manganese arsenide, so why do we have this anisotropy along this axis which we don't expect from the crystal symmetry? We have the what we think is the metal insulated transition in gallium manganese arsenide. Do we indeed see the Afrostovsky gap? Is our interpretation complete now? How do we do this modeling of the quantum fluctuations? Well, I'd like to discuss why we don't see so far the intrinsic spin Hall effect or anomalous Hall effect. There may be other experimental reasons that I haven't thought of, but we should try and identify them. And of course, I would like to discuss some possible experiments on quantum spin Hall effect, quantum insulator spin Hall effect, anomalous Hall effect, and all the like. Trying to define something that really gives an experiment which can directly state something. And the main thing there is that I need signals which are somewhat bigger, of the order of a percent at least, to really make a hard statement on whether there's an effect there or not. Okay, thank you for your attention.
Can I ask a question about
sure.
the self-assembled dots, I guess, is it?
Yep.
RTDs.
Yep.
So if I imagine that there's, I guess statistically you have some average number of manganese in the dots.
Well, we think we have some 20 manganese atoms contributing within the area of the wave function on the dot, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So let's just say I want to understand why the splitting you see can't be this kind of effect.
Mm-hmm.
So let me make it much simpler than your case. Let's say there's one manganese.
Yeah.
And that when you tunnel, you're going between, for example, having no electrons on the dot and having one.
Yeah.
then if you have one electron on the dot, there are two states for that one electron, right? If I just imagine a simple model with...
Zero B, your spin axis is not defined, so...
Let's say zero B, for example,
yeah.
Right? Then let's say there's some exchange coupling between the band electron that's tunneling and the manganese there.
Yeah.
Then quantum mechanically, if I have some exchange interaction, I'm going to get, for this one electron, I'm going to get some splitting between states, right, from the exchange interaction. So, in your, why can't it be that kind of effect that gives a splitting?
There's some kind of proximity effect.
Yeah.
There is magnetization in the ball, it will penetrate into the building.
I mean, how strong would such an effect be? Would it really be something that survives up to 20 Kelvin?
I may be missing the point. Absolutely.
I have a manganese here.
But I'm just saying that, let's say there's a quantum dot where I have a Hamiltonian, little s dot big s, right?
Yeah.
And these are the one electron state, and there are two 1-electron state energies. Even if you're at infinite temperature and you average over all orientations of the spin, that splitting is still there.
The manganese will be
plus a half and S minus a half, right?
But I think the
in zero.
But I think the exchange between the band electrons and the manganese will be pretty small because they're pretty far away. So I don't think this will be a very, very strong splitting.
Between the manganese and the dot and the tunneling electron.
Yes. Well, once it's on the dot, it will be a bit bigger splitting, of course.
Yeah. So why can't it be that bigger splitting?
Do you really think that would be an effect that I could observe up to 20 Kelvin?
Well, you could observe that in my model up to infinite Kelvin. But my model might be unrealistic because if there are many manganese, then the spectrum is actually much more complicated, and maybe you wouldn't expect to see something so simple.
Well, of course, there will be always a dominating manganese. That's something you can always say. Well.
Magnetic field.
That's the standard picture of a DMS, a paramagnetic DMS, that you locally will have some order in the manganese. Especially if you have some local electrons that overlap, you can have this big complex of manganese locally that more or less are in the same direction. Another question is why do we see this effect at these high temperatures? That's basically how we've been modeling this. I have no real feeling whether your effect, I would expect it to be much smaller even than the polaron effect that actually we are starting from. But this should really work out. If you have one electron and you have some local manganese here, to get the effective electron always in the same, always has to be in the same direction, at least that's what we assume. I do a constant current experiment. Now, why would we always get...
So it's just the relative orientation, quantum mechanically, of the tunneling electron and the manganese spin.
But why would you always get a resonance that would be always, well, with a single manganese, you would always get the same resonance position. Right?
Yeah.
And then what you're saying is that if you have a transport experiment, you should always see the splitting, and if you do an optics experiment, you will never see anything.
Uh-huh. So, and I haven't seen actually. Well,
people have reported that they think they
yes, see that's it. Right. But
I would say we are as
good as
and for gallium-manganese arsenide, where you're at a single manganese in the arsenide, you're interacting with manganese spin with a hole, the Raman estimates are on the order of 2 or 3 millivolts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you scale it down to the production band, you probably get this one problem.
So that's also a similar single polaron effect then we keep talking about, or yeah. 1 millivolt splitting, yep.
How big was the splitting in your figure?
Well, that's of the order of a few millivolts, so I can go back there. In principle, yes. I don't know whether I can make contacts on them. I should be careful. But you see, it's of the order of, 5 to 10 millivolts, and there will be a factor of 2 because of the 2 barriers there. So that's the order of magnitude. It is pretty big. With holes, I would have to go to another material system. That's how I might do it. You expect bigger splittings?
Well, if this was the mechanism, you'd expect a 5 or 10 times bigger.
But you would expect it also for the polaron thing, I guess, because, yeah.
Another question to your biaxial and isotope that you mentioned.
Yep.
System. And there you showed this cartoon, you know, with the traffic potential and the manual track in there and
yep.
Tunneling you indicate. I mean, did you really look at that, or was this a suggestion you want to look into? Or?
Whether there's a domain wall in the, whether it's domain wall nucleation.
And the tunneling out
Well, this is ongoing work, yes. So we're looking into domain wall dynamics and everything.
You have seen already some indication that there is tunneling?
Whether it's tunneling, no. But we could discuss whether we could think of an experiment to see whether it's tunneling. So I didn't really do activation studies or something like that. I mean, we do look at domain walls. I mean, all this stuff where you transfer a domain wall through a current to another constriction, stuff like that. That's stuff we are into, yes. But we should talk about an experiment.
Okay.